definite concern. These incidents increased from 971 in 2010-11 to 1,194 in 2011-12, which resulted mainly from factors such as labor disputes and disruption with service delivery. It is clear that incidents of this nature are increasing in numbers and in nature, and that they are becoming increasingly violent. The South African Police Service must develop a definite plan of action to address these incidents and stabilize such as soon as possible to prevent escalation thereof. The reasons for the increase in public unrest incidents needs to be investigated by relevant government departments in order to address, and business in order to address the situation and to reduce the frequency of these incidents. The recruitment and training of public order police members is of paramount importance and must receive urgent attention. We focus on constitutional principles. Police officers can no longer be allowed to use excessive force when stabilizing public unrest incidents. It is against our constitution and against our human rights culture. Last year we received a comprehensive briefing by SAPS on public order policing, the interaction between the committee and SAPS on how they deal with public unrest incidents will be given special attention and focus in the next financial year. Members, we're starting with our second day of public hearings on the Zero Bill, the Amendment Bill, and we have first off our presenters from the Controller Risk South Africa, is that correct? Yeah. Presented here by legal representatives that will introduce themselves as we go on. Mr. Leon, I hand over to yourself. You can start the presentation. You can introduce your team. We will now present, and then I will allow members to ask questions of clarity, and we will then give you an opportunity to respond to those as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Peter Leon of Webber Wenzel. I'm here with my colleague, Jonathan Veeren, also Webber Wenzel, and we represent Control Risk South Africa Pty Limited, which is a risk management consultancy. And I'll tell you more about them as we go along through the presentation. So just to give you an overview of the presentation itself, we're going to look at a number of issues in relation to the bill. Effectively, there are two clauses which we are particularly concerned with, Madam Chair, and they are clauses 9 and clause 11 of the bill, which I'm going to deal with in some detail. And we're concerned about these provisions for two very broad reasons. The one is the impact that clause 9 of the bill has on section 25 of the Constitution, which is the property clause in the Constitution. We're going to talk about that. And secondly, the impact clause 9 has on the bilateral investment treaty between the United Kingdom and South Africa, which was signed by President Mandela and Prime Minister John Major in September 1994 and came to force in 1998 and is still in force, and even if it were to be terminated by the South African government, it would continue for another 20 years after its termination. We're also going to discuss clause 11 of the bill in relation to the equality clause of the Constitution, which is section 9. The concern we have there is the whole issue of permanent residence, which I know has been a concern to this committee already, and we'll explain why we think that is a problem. And then finally, we're going to look at the vague and ambiguous and what we regard as overly broad provisions in the bill itself, both in relation to clause 9 and clause 11, and particularly in relation to the what we regard as the overbroad discretion afforded to the Minister of Police under the bill. Anyway, just to describe the business of Control Risks, as I said at the beginning, Control Risk is a global risk and strategic consulting firm. It's one of the largest in the world. It's based in London, the United Kingdom. It has offices in many, many countries. It's really involved in the political risk business and in the corporate intelligence business, and essentially it involves information-led risk management. Now, Control Risks, what it wants
disclose it. I can see members can't hear you with sitting at the back, especially. Thank you.
Okay, sure. What Control Risk do? What Control Risk would like to do is provide a high value-added service to its South African clients, both in South Africa and in Africa as a whole. And as a result of that, and because it obviously wishes to comply with the Act, it is in the process of registering itself as a security services provider. You might ask the question, I'm sure it will be asked, why it hasn't done so already, but it has in fact applied to CIRA for registration. As such, it made that application late last year. That application is still in the process of being assessed, and there's been some back and forth between the company and CIRA around that. Essentially, it was in relation to the qualifications of the company's directors as to whether or not they were permanent residents. What I can say is that the Control Risk is in the process of appointing executive and non-executive directors who are both South African citizens, either South African citizens or permanent residents in South Africa. Now, that has an immediate implication for what the bill proposes, Madam Chair, because as you'll appreciate, the bill takes away the provisions in the Act which allows a permanent resident to be a qualified director of the company or a senior manager of the company and only vests that power in citizens. And so that creates an immediate problem for us, irrespective of anything else. And that's beyond the issue of the 51% indigenization requirement which the bill proposes. So if I can go on to talk about the problematic clauses of the bill, as I said at the beginning, the concerns we have are broadly in relation to clauses 9 and clause 11. In relation to clause 9, the first concern, I know this committee has heard this already, is the 51% South African citizenship requirement. The business must be owned and controlled. It's not just owned, it also has to be controlled by South African citizens. There is admittedly a provision for the minister to prescribe different percentages of local ownership for certain categories of security services. The problem with that is that there's no provision in the bill as it stands as to what time frame this is going to happen in, nor is there any indication of whether those percentages would be adjusted upwards or downwards, so they could be above 51% or below it. Admittedly, there is a transitional provision in the bill that the 51% requirement, which is the compulsory divestiture requirement, will only kick in over 5 years, but it doesn't address the problem, Madam Chair, of the problem of permanent residents no longer being qualified to be part of a security service provider. The other problem, I mean, I'll deal with this in more detail, but I mean, clearly the equity divestiture problem raises some serious problems under the Constitution because there's no provision in Clause 9 as to compensating companies which are subject to this equity divestiture, and it's not clear on what basis they would be compensated, whether that compensation would follow the requirements of the Constitution. So then, as I say, Clause 11 is the other problematic provision in the bill. It amends Section 23 of the Act and says that every natural person who wishes to register as a security service provider under the Act must be a South African citizen, as opposed to being either a citizen or a permanent resident. And then it says that a security service provider which is incorporated as a company must be 51% owned and controlled by South African citizens. Now, as I said, in relation to Clause 9, the problem with Clause 11 is it doesn't contain a transitional period within which security businesses could make the necessary arrangements to comply with these amended registration requirements. And I'm going to obviously talk about these issues in a lot more detail. But just, and you would, it would be a fair question to ask, I mean, how do these clauses concern Control Risk, and where does it leave the company? And I think the first point I'd like to make is that As things stand at the moment, the company would not be able to meet the 51% South African ownership and control requirement, because it has no plans at the moment to divest itself of 51% of its equity. But the second problem, even if it were able to do so, and I have to emphasize that this applies to everybody who's going to be subject to the bill, it would be obviously in the situation of a forced sale, which will have some impact on what value any security service provider which is foreign owned would get for its shares under a forced sale to a fairly closed market. And the second problem, which is a particular problem for this company, is that, as I said at the beginning, its key executives and managerial staff are in the process or have applied for permanent resident status, which is an ongoing process, as you know, under the Immigration Act. And even if that were to happen, once this bill kicks in, they would be required to be South African citizens. So that has another implication for the company. So, I mean, essentially there are three problems here. The one is the compulsory divestiture, 51%. The second is that the company, the group, control risk group, would no longer be able to control its South African subsidiary, Control Risk South Africa, because of the citizenship requirement. And potentially, and you know, this question needs to be asked to the to CIRA, Control Risk may be in a situation, as would any other security company, of having to dismiss all its directors or managers who are not South African citizens, because it's not clear from the bill what impact it would have, whether it would operate, for example, retrospectively. So those are really, in summary, what the concerns are in relation to the bill that we have. But I want to analyse it both from a constitutional perspective and in terms of the bilateral investment treaty. And from a constitutional perspective, our concerns are really these. The first is that there, in our view, the bill breaches directly Section 25 of the Constitution, which is the property clause. And I just want to, with respect, remind members that the property clause of the Constitution, 1996, says no one can be deprived of property except under a law of general application, and no law may permit the arbitrary deprivation of property. Property can only be expropriated for a public purpose or in the public interest, and then it has to be subject to compensation. And property includes shares in a company. So clearly, this, on the face of it, is an expropriation, because the shares are compulsorily divested from the shareholder. And in our submission, Madam Chair, it is, first of all, a deprivation of property, because the Constitutional Court, in a number of decisions on the property clause, has held that any interference with property rights constitutes a deprivation. Section 25 requires an expropriation or deprivation to take place under law of general application, but as I said, it cannot be arbitrary, so there has to be sufficient reason for the deprivation that must be for a public purpose or in the public interest and subject to compensation. And certainly it's our submission that the bill as it stands at the moment doesn't meet any of these requirements. I just want to show the committee why. Our reasons for saying this are really the following. There doesn't seem to be a sufficiently reasonable or rational connection between the deprivation itself, which is the divestiture, and the bill's purpose. If you look at the objects of the bill, which are paragraph 1 in the memorandum on the objects of the bill, the department has said that there is an, quote, I'm quoting from the objects, an increased threat to national security posed by the participation of foreign nationals in the industry as a challenge to the industry. Now, that may be so, and they presumably have investigated these issues. But the memorandum doesn't explain how foreign nationals pose a threat. Now, even if that could be explained, our difficulty is that it doesn't seem to draw any link between permanent residence and the threat to national security, nor does it seem to explain how the 51% equity divestiture or the change in control of the security business will diminish that threat, bearing in mind that foreigners could still own 49%. 10% of the company. And it just, all of this just doesn't seem to be terribly rational. And I also thought it would be useful just to remind the committee that under Section 198 of the Constitution, national security must reflect the resolve of South Africans to live as equals, and it must be pursued in compliance with the law, including international law. And the Constitutional Court, again, Madam Chair, in a number of cases, has refused to allow the government or the state to rely on national security interest to justify the infringement of the constitutionally protected rights, including the right to a fair dismissal, the right to freedom of expression, and the right to open justice. And just in that regard, and obviously it's in our written submission, just thought I would, a very short quote from the Constitutional Court judgment in the Settler and the President of the Republic of South Africa in 2008, which obviously some members will recall concerned the disclosure of an in-camera affidavit which independent newspapers were trying to obtain. And the court said, Judge Sachs on behalf of the court said that exemptions including those set out in favour of national security are presented as exceptions and not as the norm. So that really is very much emphasises the approach taken by the court. And then finally, as I said at the beginning, there's no provision in the bill for compensation, and in our view clause 9 of the bill cannot be justified under the limitation clause of the Constitution, which is section 36. It doesn't seem to us to be any cogent relationship between the limitation and its purpose, and there may well be less restrictive means for the state or the government to manage this perceived threat to national security. Then if I can go on to the bilateral investment treaty issues, these obviously are not constitutional issues, but they're international law issues, because as I said at the beginning, South Africa has signed a number of bilateral investment treaties with other states. I think there are over 40, 45 as far as I recall, but about half of which are actually now in force. And under these treaties, the South African government has undertaken a number of things, but most important of all, it's undertaken not to expropriate foreign property except for full market value compensation. It's also undertaken not to treat foreign investments unfairly or inequitably. It's also undertaken not to discriminate in relation to foreign investments in South Africa. As I say, the UK has an existing bilateral investment treaty with South Africa, which came into force in 1998. And in our view, this bill as it stands creates a number of problems under it. The first is in relation to Article 2, which is fair and equitable treatment. This requires that South Africa provide fair and equitable treatment to UK investments in South Africa. And one of the requirements there is that those investments are not treated unreasonably or in a discriminatory manner. And it requires South Africa to act in good faith, without ambiguity, and in a manner which is not arbitrary or discriminatory. And, you know, for the same reasons we submitted in relation to, on the constitutional issues, we submit that the bill, clause 9 of the bill, seems to be unreasonable because it doesn't seem to be a rational relationship between the equity divestiture provision and its purpose. And more particularly, the bill is discriminatory and breaches the treaty because it brings about an unjustifiably differential treatment of UK investors and investments in South Africa on the basis of their nationality. And that is a very problematic provision because it directly implicates the treaty. And I'll show you why. Because clause 3 of the treaty, the bilateral investment treaty, deals with national treatment. And it says that UK investments in South Africa, or South Africa shall not subject the investments and returns UK nationals to treatment which is less favourable than that which it accords to its own nationals or companies. So South Africa cannot subject UK nationals or companies as regards their management, maintenance, use or disposal of their investments to treatment which is less favourable than that which it accords its own nationals or companies. And so what you have in this bill, Madam Chair, is differential treatment for security businesses which are majority owned and controlled by South African citizens and those which are not. And this is all related to the nationality of the investor. So basically limits the security businesses in South Africa in violation of the treaty. And obviously, clearly, South African-owned businesses are going to be in a much better position than businesses which are foreign-owned. But the fact that that may be a policy choice on the part of the government, the problem is it violates the treaty. And then, finally, on the treaty, Article 5 of the treaty deals with expropriation. It allows expropriation to take place, and I want to emphasize that, but it has to be done in a way which is lawful. So the expropriation must be for a public purpose, which this may well be, but it has to be on a non-discriminatory basis again, and it has to be for prompt, adequate, and effective compensation. And international tribunals have interpreted that term, which actually comes out of the Mexican nationalizations in the 1930s, to mean that full market value compensation has to be paid to the investor. And it's our submission, therefore, that the bill violates the bilateral investment treaty. Clause 9 of the bill violates the UK-South Africa bilateral investment treaty, as it doesn't provide for compensation, full market value compensation as required by Article 5.2, and that the compulsory equity divestiture provisions discriminates against foreign nationals on the basis of their United Kingdom citizenship. So I want to then deal with Clause 11 of the bill, which is the issue in relation to permanent residence. Obviously the issues here are really, again, constitutional, because they implicate Section 9 of the Constitution, which deals with the right to equality. And it's our submission that, I mean, I think it's hopefully clear from my introduction that Control Risks has in place executives and managers who are in the process of becoming permanent residents. They would, as a result of this bill, have to become citizens, and the question, obviously, is whether they could actually qualify to continue to manage and run the business at all. I think they would not. They would not be able to do so as long as they were not citizens. So it's our submission that Clause 11 potentially violates the right to equality of a permanent resident, and that is because it brings about differential treatment of people on the basis of their nationality. And that has implications for Section 9.3 of the Constitution, because discrimination on the grounds of citizenship has been held by the Constitutional Court to amount to an analogous ground of discrimination, which would be prohibited by the Constitution. And I just thought it might be useful for the members to have a look at Section 25. I know it's a different act. Section 25.1 of the Immigration Act of 2002, which says the permanent residents, quote, have all the rights, privileges, duties, and obligations of a citizen, save for those rights, privileges, duties, and obligations which a law, the Constitution, explicitly ascribes to citizenship. And obviously, the most important of those would be the right to vote. The Immigration Act obviously doesn't exclude permanent residents from employment positions, and the reason that that is obviously axiomatic. The reason they are permanent residents is they can get employed or have permanent employment in South Africa. What I want to emphasize is permanent residence isn't something that just drops out of the air. People who apply for it have to go through a process of being screened by the Department of Home Affairs, meet the requirements of the Immigration Act, and then are given permanent residence. And it is quite an extensive process. So it's not something that can just be ignored. The Constitutional Court has looked at this issue, Madam Chair, on two occasions. The first time, some time ago, in 1997, which involved a question of the employment of permanent residents in the Northwest Province, permanent residents who were teachers, where the province took a decision, the court said incorrectly or unlawfully, to exclude them from permanent employment. And Judge Yvonne Mahoro, on behalf of the unanimous court, said the following. I thought I should read it out. She said, in my view, these are regulations which deal with excluding the permanent residents from permanent employment, clearly constitute unfair discrimination. They have been selected for residence in this country by the Immigrant Selection Board, some of them on the basis of recruitment to specific posts. Permanent residents are generally entitled to citizenship within a few years of gaining permanent residency, and be said to have made a conscious commitment to South Africa. I would emphasize that. Moreover, permanent residents are entitled to compete with South Africans in the employment market. As emphasized by the appellants, it makes little sense to permit people to stay permanently in a country, but then to exclude them from a job they are qualified to perform. And I think that applies absolutely directly to the present case. And that is for the following reasons. The first is that I think it's going to be difficult for the government to establish the discrimination, as this bill proposes, between citizens and permanent residents is fair, which is going to be the test under the Constitution, for several reasons. The one is, first of all, that the Constitutional Court has already held that permanent residents are entitled to protection. Secondly, the bill and the explanatory memorandum don't really seem to establish any link between the supposed threat to national security and a change in control of security businesses from permanent residents to South African citizens. And the very, Madam Chair, the really severely adverse impact on the interests of permanent residents which this bill would bring about, because it would have a direct impact on that person's ability to earn a living in this country and in their job security. And in fact, in Kosovo's, the Minister of Social Development, which is a more recent case, the Constitutional Court held, again on the discrimination case in relation to permanent residents, that the intentional, statutorily sanctioned, unequal treatment of part of the South African community has, the court said, a strong stigmatizing effect. So, I mean, that's how the Constitutional Court has approached this issue. And again, for the same reasons we would advance in relation to Clause 9, we don't think this clause is going to pass constitutional scrutiny under the limitation clause for a number of reasons. The first is the fundamental right to equality. The second is that the discriminatory measures in relation to permanent residents appear to have no legitimate government purpose. The discriminatory measures impose a severe limitation on the rights of permanent residents, and there do seem to be less restrictive means which could be adopted in this case. Then just finally, I want to deal with the overly broad provisions in the bill. The first is the degree of control to be given to South African citizens. I've already touched on this. I'll just touch on it again briefly. That's the clauses 9 and 11 of the bill are on executive and managerial functions. You can't be registered as a security business unless 51% of the business owned and controlled by South African citizens. Control seems to appear to relate to directors and persons performing executive or managerial functions. No person may perform executive or managerial functions as a director or of a security service provider unless they are a South African citizen. Now, there does seem to be an ambiguity in the bill, Madam Chair, here, because, and this is an issue I would emphasize, the 51% requirement applies to Clause 9A, where the 51% equity has to be South African owned. But Section 23.2A, read with 23.1A, as amended by Clause 11, may effectively require 100% of the business to be controlled by South African citizens. And the reason for that, Madam Chair, is really because you can't register under the Act as a security service provider unless the directors and managers of the company are all South African citizens. So even though you might only have 49% of the business could still be UK owned, none of the management could be permanent residents. None of the management could be all the management and all the executive directors and all the directors would have to be South African citizens. So control risks or any company in their possession would have to ensure that none of their management were South African citizens, none of their management were permanent residents. And effectively, I think that creates control by the back door, because I struggle to think how a foreign-owned company would be able to have any control of its business if none of the directors could be permanent residents. It just doesn't work. So we say that is a position, a provision. very carefully. And then the other problem with Clause 11, I have touched on this already, is that it doesn't contain any transitional provision, unlike Clause 9, which has the five-year period. There's no transitional provision in relation to Clause 11. And it's also not clear, I assume, I very much hope it's not the case, that the provision, whether or not the provision is to apply retrospectively, what companies do who are on the process of registering, or if they are registered, is the regulator going to turn around to them and say, no, you have to have all your management and all your directors have to be South African citizens. What is the approach going to be to that? And then just finally, and this has been quite a long presentation, the discretion afforded to the minister under Clause 9B of the bill, I did touch on this at the beginning, and that is there's a very broad discretion given to the minister to prescribe different percentages of ownership and control. He is to be guided by the, quote, security interests of the Republic, but that's a rather vague test, and I just thought I'd again draw the committee's attention to the important constitutional court decision, the Affordable Medicine Trust, the Minister of Health, fairly recent decision in 2005, where the court said the discretion conferred on an official must not be so broad or vague that the authority to whom the power is delegated is unable to determine the nature and the scope of the powers conferred. This may well lead to the arbitrary exercise of the delegated power. And it's arguable, Madam Chair, that this is contrary to the rule of law principle enshrined in the Constitution, which requires legislation to be written in, not to be written in vague and ambiguous terms by affording the minister too broad a discretion. And then just finally, as a sort of more of a public policy comment, I'll just say that, you know, I think this bill is very inaptly timed, given the fall in foreign direct investment in South Africa. An UNCTAD report recently reported that South African FDI has declined by 43% over the last 12 months and may well decline further. This doesn't seem to be sending out a very good message to foreign investors about the safety and security of their investments in South Africa. I just thought I would conclude by saying from our perspective, from control risks perspective, the bill is likely to have a very negative impact on their business going forward. The amendments appear to be irrational because there doesn't appear to be any rational connection between the measures proposed and a legitimate government purpose. The bill may well infringe on the rights of control risks under Clause 9 and other companies who are in the same position in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution under the UK-South Africa Bilateral Investment Treaty, and Clause 11 of the bill may well violate the right to equality in Section 9 of the Constitution in relation to its treatment of permanent residents. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leon. Can I ask that you email the presentation to the Secretary of the Committee so that we have copies of it? It just makes it easier for us to do so. Can I express my unhappiness with the late arrival of CIRA? The meeting was delayed, waiting for CIRA to arrive. It's disrespectful, not only to the committee, but also to the people who are making public presentations on what is essentially your bill. It will not happen again. If it happens again, I will take it up with the relevant minister. And the fact that no apology was forwarded either is not acceptable either. Can we continue with questions from member side? I would like to, after members have asked questions, also get the state law advisors and CIRA to comment specifically on the constitutional issues that was raised, as well as on the trade agreement issues that were raised and the citizenship issue. Members, questions? Mr. George?
Madam Chair, I want to thank the report because it raised a lot of legalities, but you see, he raised the issue of permanent residence. But I did not hear him. I thought he was going to be able to say these are the rights of permanent residents. And probably say, because I didn't hear him, so I would like him to be very clear. Are the rights of permanent residents the same as that of South African citizens? You must remember there is a section 36 in the constitution of this country which limits rights. So I would like you to comment on that. You also talk about the transitional period. The way you put it is that you develop. But you see, are you saying, because if you talk a transitional period, to me that indicates that you are happy with the bill. You ask also questions, what if the company does not meet the 51% at the prescribed period? Is that your real concern? Because I think if that's your real concern, surely this is a matter that must be that can be addressed. You say the bill is discriminatory. I would like you to elaborate you so that we know exactly where is this discrimination. And also I would like you to explain to me, you quoted a case, but the case you are quoting was dealing more with employment. I want you to say the ownership of property or business, is it the same as employment? Because I would be very happy if you can, if you say there's no difference, fine. But I would like you to give me that, is it employment and ownership? Because we're talking ownership, you're not talking employment. There has been this thing of negative impact on business. I would like you to want to say to you, because this is my last question, do you believe that what the changes are correct? Because if you believe the changes are correct, whatever impact they have, any change does not, sometimes does, especially at the beginning, have a negative impact.
Honourable Kulu Barnett and the Honourable Ndlovu.
Thank you. I think what we have to understand is this is a basic framework for a considered bill. This is us now working on something that we've been given. It does seem to me, and it's been raised by a number of the presenters, that this insistence on South African citizens only is problematic from all sides. Would many of the issues be resolved if it said in the bill South African citizens or permanent residents? Would that resolve, because it seems to me that actually would align or realign a great deal of what is said in there. The expropriation issue, I don't know that could be altered in some way. Perhaps you have a suggestion. The expropriation of majority shareholding of a company would set a legal precedent, obviously, if it ever got through the Constitutional Court, which I don't know how it could. It would obviously be challenged in court. But is there some way you could see that in itself could be altered that would pull it into line with the Constitution? Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. There are around about three areas, but some of those areas have been touched by these two colleagues of mine. I want to ask about no transitional period being stipulated in Clause 11, but it's applicable on Clause 9, but it's not applicable on Clause 11. Can you just elaborate, Mr. Leon, on that? the second one, chairperson, in clause 11 said it violates the rights of the equality. Can you just educate me? I'm just a layman. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a politician. I'm just a sweeper. The applicant.
Queen Le Bonnat is asking whether you're not a politician, because you said you're not.
I'm just a sweeper of the politician. That is why I'm next to the door. But Colonel Barnett, always do this to me, Jefferson, please.
Let yourself be distracted. Continue, please. Do you protect it?
No. I was looking at Mr. Leon. I'm looking on. He said the violation of right of equality. I jotted that down, that sentence. You said it. And you talk about discretion of the minister. The discretion of the minister is broad and vague. You use those two words, broad and vague. We'll elaborate on those three questions, please. Thank you very much.
Really have a new question.
No, just one question which I forgot. Is the question you raised, the question of the UK South African bilateral? But I want to be very clear. Are you suggesting that if the UK South Africa bilateral is observed as is written in it, there will be nothing wrong with the bill?
Okay. In that question, just it down through you, Jefferson. In that question, does this bill have an impact on that bilateral? If the answer is yes, how? If no, how?
Honourable Molebatsi.
Thanks, Chairperson. Mine is just want to know about the discrimination against the foreign nationals. What is your recommendation? You spoke of this discrimination. What is your recommendation?
The issue around, I'm not going to repeat questions that have been asked, the issue around the broadness of the minister's powers is obviously something that can be addressed by this committee in terms of providing clear guidelines and measures that should be taken in the process, that should be embarked upon, in line also with administrative justice. If the committee do that, would that address that concern? Because you do have to have some sort of discretionary powers to the minister, especially in the transitional period and in the implementation of this. And it's also not unheard of in any legislation. If I hear you correctly, your concern is more the fact that it's not guided enough and that it's not transparent enough. So if you can just comment on that. I'm going to allow that. I'm going to allow the state law advisors to respond after Mr. Leon has answered the questions.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair. I'll answer the questions best I can. Just to deal with Honourable George's questions on permanent residents, what are their rights? Are they the same as citizens? I hopefully did try and address that in the presentation somewhere. But I referred to the Immigration Act, to Section 25, 27, and to some of the case law around this. What I was really trying to say is that the Constitutional Court has said that the rights of a permanent resident are very close to that of a citizen, but clearly they do not have the right. They do not have the right to vote. Permanent residents are not dealt with in the way citizens are in the Constitution, but the Constitutional Court has said that discrimination against them can amount to an analogous ground of discrimination in terms of Section 9(3) of the Constitution. So clearly they are not in the same position as a citizen, but their rights are very close to that of a citizen because they can live in the country, live and work in the country on a permanent basis. And as I said in my presentation, they have to go through quite an extensive screening process before they are given permanent residence. In relation to the question on the transitional provisions, the question was asked whether I was happy with the bill, and the short answer is, hopefully from my submission, I indicated that I'm not, or we are not, because the bill does have implications, constitutional implications, in relation to clauses 9 and 11, and in relation to the UK-South Africa Bilateral Investment Treaty. And then I was asked the question, why is the bill discriminatory? It's discriminatory in two respects. The one is in the relation to how it discriminates between permanent residents and South African citizens, and we say that is on a rather irrational basis, which doesn't seem to be justified in the explanatory memorandum. And secondly, it violates the, and so that has implications for the Constitution, because it violates the Equality Clause. And secondly, we say that it violates the UK-South Africa Bilateral Investment Treaty, which specifically prohibits discrimination against UK investors in South Africa. And that's absolutely plain from the provisions of the treaty. And I'd absolutely agree with Member George, the Honourable George, that ownership is not the same as employment, but we're dealing with two different issues. There's the ownership issue, which is dealt with in Clause 9, and the employment issue was really dealt with in Clause 11, which is the permanent residence clause. I was also asked the question, what impact would this have on business? And I think the impact on investments in South Africa would be very bad. And we're facing a very difficult situation in this country in terms of declining foreign direct investment, a trade balance, which is now, we now have a current account deficit, I think I saw 6.5%. The RAND has been affected by all of that, so this is not a good time to be making foreign investors nervous. In fact, it's absolutely the worst time to do so. So the impact on business in our submission would be very negative. In answer to Honourable Colabar's questions, her first question was in relation to permanent residence on the issue of Clause 11. I think this committee could fix a major problem with the bill by reinstating the provision in the Act which allowed permanent residents to be managed or be a director of a security company. I think that would be the committee would address a number of the problems in the bill, certainly in relation to Clause 11, by doing so. At the same time, that would not answer the expropriation issue, but the expropriation issue, and I'm sure the committee wants some views on this, the expropriation issue could also potentially be fixed in terms of making the bill constitutional by making provision for compensation, which it doesn't do at the moment. There's no provision at all for compensation. To answer Honourable Ndlovu's question on the transitional provisions, what did I mean in relation to Clause 11, where there was no transitional provision, and what I mean in relation to Clause 9, what I'm suggesting is it's not clear what the impact of Clause 11 would be, whether it would kick in immediately, whether the regulator would give, assuming the permanent residence exclusion stays, whether the regulator would give the companies a number of years to comply with it so they could employ South African citizens in the management and directorship of the company. I think it's still going to be problematic, but the fact is there's no transitional provision, and I'm not suggesting that putting a transitional provision into the bill would fix the problem. I think the problem can only be fixed by reinstating the rights of permanent residents. On the equality clause, what do I mean by the violation of equality rights? What I tried to suggest in relation to Section 9 of the Constitution is that permanent residents have rights which the Constitutional Court has protected under the Constitution, and those were the cases that I was referring to. Admittedly, the one involved school teachers, but they're still in an employment situation. And Clause 11 has a directly impacts employees of the company. In terms of the discretion of the minister. to that was also a question asked by the chair, that what do I mean by broad and vague. I completely agree with the chair's comments that what the discretion needs to be is to be guided. And that's what the Constitutional Court has said in a number of cases on this issue. So the discretions, the Constitutional Court has recognized correctly that you have to have some discretion. You can't have a regulator or a minister who has no discretion at all. But that discretion has to be guided, has to be limited. I was also asked the question, what impact does the bill have on the bilateral investment treaty with the UK? I think it has a very negative impact on the BIT, because both in relation to the expropriation clause, which is Article 5 of the BIT, and the differential treatment of UK investors in South Africa, which is unjustified differentiation and has implications for the anti-discrimination provisions of the bilateral investment treaty and the unfair and inequitable provisions of the treaty. Honourable Malabatsa asked a similar question about discrimination against foreign nationals. How do I propose that's dealt with? I think I've answered that question in relation to the points I made about the permanent residence. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Just in response to Mr. Leon's submission, Chair, I think it's important to note, first of all, with regard to the bilateral agreement, Mr. Leon acknowledged that it does not pose any constitutional issues. There could be other implications with regard to the undertaking by the respective the government of South Africa and the UK with regard to trade arrangements, basically. But from a constitutional perspective, in our view, does also not, we agree with Mr. Leon, it does not pose any constitutional issues. Chairperson, the next issue which I would like to respond to is with regard to the permanent residence, the exclusion in terms of the bill. There's a lot of comments in respect of the exclusion and the consequences of the exclusion. But it's also important to know that laws change all the time. Policies is presented before Parliament in the form of draft legislation, and the test is the Constitution. At the moment, as permanent residents, they enjoy similar rights with regard to South African citizens, except for the political rights, the right to vote. They do permanent residence applicants for permanent residence permits do go through a process with regard to in respect of the immigration laws. That is correct. We also, what we have before, what's before Parliament in terms of the bill, the draft bill, is the private security industry, which regulates activities in respect of security service. And all its functions as stipulated in the Principal Act. What we have before, what Parliament is considering at the moment is a limitation in respect of the registration persons who will be entitled to register as security service providers. And the test is whether this limitation is justifiable in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution. Chairperson is also to note that the Constitutional Court pronounced previously in respect of other matters with regard to the rights of permanent residents. But it's important to also be aware of the purpose of having this legislation before Parliament. And the purpose, what must be considered, or the objective, is the security interest of the country. And the security interest of the country relates to the private security sector. And that is a particular sector. It poses particular risks and threats. There has been comparative studies in respect of reform of the security service in other countries, and I think the Minister alluded to the comparative views in respect of where that sector has transformed. And in the bill, there's also presented the limitation of rights of permanent residence, and also with regard to foreign ownership in respect of security services. And the limitation is based on the security interest of the Republic. The 51% ownership percentage is one of the requirements for the transformation within the sector with regard to foreign ownership. It can also, in terms of clause 9.2.9b, also be lower or less. It can be more or less with regard to the control of ownership. That is the requirement. Chairperson, what we could look at from our perspective is maybe to look at the process with regard to the minister's discretion in order to assist the committee to strengthen the provision with regard to the exemption with regard to certain categories of businesses that will be exempted from the requirements stated in the bill. So, Chairperson, from our point of view, also with regard to the expropriation, in our view, it's not an expropriation. It does not amount to deprivation because security companies current who have to conform to the new requirements, they will have an opportunity to sell the shares or to they've got 5 years to transform to the new to comply with the new requirements. In our view, it's a market that is attractive. From a business perspective, I'm sure security companies would be able to ensure that the interest is also protected as far as that is concerned. I'm not sure. My colleague would just want to add something to you.
Thanks, Chair. What I would like to add, Chair, is that it is not entirely correct, Chairperson, to say citizens and permanent residents have the same rights. They do not have the same rights. Citizens, permanent residents, Chairperson, are subject to conditions in terms of the law. You apply for permanent residence, you're granted permanent residence, you're subject to conditions that are set in your permanent residence status. One of those conditions would be sticking to the employment relationship that you would have been granted, the employment field that you would have been granted as a condition to follow in South Africa. That's in terms of the immigration laws, Chairperson. The second issue is the case that was referred to, the Labi Odam case. It's distinguishable from this particular scenario. Labi Odam dealt with the issue of teachers, which are distinguishable from the private security industry. There was a specific case that dealt with the private security industry, which is the Union Refugee case. And in that case, the court realized that the security industry is a particular environment that is different from other environments. The other distinguishing factor is that with regard to the Labi Odam case, the main motivation there was a job reservation for South Africans, which is not the case in this instance. In this instance, we're talking about the security interests of the Republic. It's not about job reservations for South Africans. So there are distinguishing factors between Labi Odam and the bill that we're dealing with. So, Chairperson, it would be misleading to use an analogy using that case. Thank you, Chairperson.
I don't want us to go into a debate now. I wanted state law advisors to clarify issues. That's why I specifically asked them to clarify issues. Hang on, members, please. Let me just finish. I want to give Cyril also an opportunity to clarify some of these issues that has been raised. We will start engaging next week. If the parliamentary law advisor was here, I would have asked the parliamentary law advisor to comment. The parliamentary law advisor is not here. And that's why I needed to clarify these issues. So, Cyril, is there anything that you want to respond to?
Madam Chair, we will be compiling a comprehensive response to the submissions, but maybe perhaps to
Paula Barnett, I'm going to allow you a question of clarity. I mean, that is what you can ask.
I have two. It would be to the state law advisors. I've heard you say on at least three occasions now, and I certainly heard the minister say on Tuesday, that the private security industry is posing a threat to South Africa, to state security. Now, I would like you to substantiate that, because we can't just keep on having this phrase repeated without some sort of substantiation.
Ivana, can I interrupt you? On Tuesday, we have state security in front of us. Who's going to speak on that issue, and we must direct the question, I would suggest, there. We cannot ask state law advisors other than legal issues, and I would urge members to hold those questions for Tuesday. Mr. George, I'm seeing you, Anne, but the Honourable Paula Barnett is still on the floor, so let her just finish, please.
All right, so if I may pose that then on Tuesday, but I'm just worried that we keep on hearing this phrase with no substantiation. My second question would be, you say there's no idea of expropriation. Are you sure they can work out ways to carry on controlling their company? How does one control a company if you're forced to sell the majority shareholding? You made that statement. I'd like you to substantiate it, please.
I don't think that's what they said. They said there was an opportunity for them to sell the 51%, a five-year period to sell that 51%. I don't think they said they can keep control, because then we're passing a farce. Mr. George, it's a question of clarity.
Question of clarity, Madam Chair. But I'm very worried about the trend these public hearings are taking. You're doing something which we have not seen, where state or law advisors respond. I thought they would have enough time when we go to them to explain certain things. You see, for instance, they've said things which you must now question, like the Honourable Paula Barnett. I'm pleading with you, Madam Chair, that we run this thing properly, as we've done in the past.
Mr. George, I am doing exactly that. But there is an opportunity. This is the opportunity to get clarification. And this is what we're doing. And I will allow members to ask questions of clarity. This is an opportunity to ask questions of clarity. If you do not have a question of clarity that you want to ask them, you don't have to. I've also explained, if the parliamentary law advisor has been here, I would have referred these questions to the parliamentary law advisor. You would have noted, Mr. George, I hope, that the parliamentary law advisor was here yesterday. Ms. Paula Barnett, second question, I think, do you want to add something to that in terms of the clarification? And Mr. George, I want to remind you that state law advisors are here to advise the committee, and they're here to advise the committee at any point in time. There is no rule around when they can advise the committee. I have also explained why we're doing it. Can we continue? Mr. Leung, thank you very much for your presentation. We will take in consideration the submissions that have been made, and we will consider some of the issues. And we will consider all of the issues when we start with the process next week. Some of it we might take on board, some of it we obviously will not be taking on board, or we might not take on board. Can we continue to the second presentation? And you will please email us the presentation. It just makes it easier for members to refer to it as well. The second presentation is going to be by the Security Industry Alliance. I'm going to give them a few minutes just to set up.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
You can continue with the presentation. Apparently you have a problem with the PowerPoint presentation. That's fine. Don't worry about it. Just continue with the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The PowerPoint slides, in any event, just provide a framework. Our submission is as per the submission that I think you have on record.
Mr. Bay, problem, sorry, I'm interrupting you. The problem is not with Parliament. There's a problem that they don't have it on their memory stick. So please, you can continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Allow me to introduce myself and my delegation. My name is Costa Diabastos. I'm an executive director at the Security Industry Alliance. Opposite me, I have Steve Conradi, who is the CEO of the Security Industry Alliance. Directly to my right, I have Mr. Dana Stradom, who is also an executive director of the Security Industry Alliance and the managing director of ADT Security in South Africa. Immediately to my left, I have Mr. Johan de Pryor and Mr. Alan Juries, who are the vice chair and chair, respectively, of the Locksmiths Association of South Africa, who are constituent members of the alliance and appeared before this committee yesterday. Allow me to begin by saying that the Security Industry Alliance is an umbrella body of large private security companies, employer organizations, trade associations, and other interested parties. We were established in 2003, and our aim was to provide a unified platform from which private security as a sector could interface with government and other stakeholders on matters of importance to the sector. We represent the interests of our members and our affiliates who employ over 150,000 people in the private security sector. And our representation spans all subsectors, including inter alia, manned guarding, electronic security and systems, response services, close protection, assets in transit, event security, manufacturers and distributors of electronic security equipment, security training, private investigations, locksmiths and security advisors. The Alliance is the largest business grouping within private security and is the only body that officially organizes broadly across all facets of the sector. A comprehensive list of our membership and affiliates is attached to our presentation, and if there are any questions about that membership, I'm happy to take them. As the Security Industry Alliance, we have for a number of years campaigned for improvements to industry regulation. Our sector is beset by an overwhelming proliferation of unregistered and or otherwise non-compliant security businesses, which has led to the rapid degradation of employment standards where minimum wage and conditions of employment are not observed and where unfair competition driven by price continues to grow in the absence of effective regulation. In view of these considerations, we have identified a number of positive aspects to the proposed bill, which are set out in our submission and I'll take you through in a moment. But we have also set out a number of negative aspects which are entirely untenable and that the Alliance wishes by this submission to challenge and to have amended or withdrawn prior to any final promulgation of legislation. The positive aspects, Honourable Chair, are the following. The amendments broadly alter and augment the manner in which CERA will be funded and how it will operate. Its status will essentially be elevated to that of an organ of state, which permits access to funding via an appropriation from the National Treasury in the budget and subjects it to fiscal oversight in accordance with the Public Finance Management Act, which has been lacking since its inception. The current funding model is not sustainable since it places the entire burden of funding regulation in the sector upon the security service providers and the ordinary workers in our sector, and this change is welcomed. Moreover, the increased accountability of the Council of CERA, as well as the strengthening of other governance functions and structures, are likewise welcomed. The amendments also appear to recognize that the private security sector is constituted of a complex interconnection between different subsectors, which extend beyond just security. security guarding into electronic security services, response, close protection, assets in transit, event security, training, private investigations, locksmiths, and security advisors. And that is just to draw reference to a few. It appears that the legislation will enable the formulation of bespoke regulations that will be made in relation to these subsectors and allow for more effective and targeted, efficient regulatory functions that actually add value. The members of the Alliance are also unanimous in their support for those measures that are more robust, that deal with the prohibition of foreign military assistance and the regulation of the deployment of South Africans into security functions in foreign territories. We welcome this. Greater oversight and control over the proliferation of firearms in the sector is also welcomed, provided, and we must make this proviso, that such control does not only amount to an increased administrative burden for security service providers, but actually assists in the legitimate licensing and deployment of firearms for appropriate purposes within the private security sector. There are a number of negative aspects, and we will deal with these. The limitation of foreign ownership within the private security sector breaches South Africa's obligations under a number of international trade agreements and treaties, and we will contend is inconsistent with the Constitution, and we will deal with this in a little bit of detail later in the submission. There are a number of provisions included in the amendments which, owing to the vague manner in which they are drafted, are likely to have unintended consequences and will essentially undermine a number of the objects of the bill. These are also dealt with in some detail later in our submission. Also, inadequate provision is made in the bill to allow for increased engagement and consultation with industry stakeholders such as security businesses, employer organizations, trade unions, and other stakeholders within the industry to allow for a strengthening of regulation within the private security sector. There is still no provision in the bill that allows for the appointment to the Council of CIRA of representatives from either the industry or from trade unions within the industry. And we believe that that is a deficiency within the current bill. I will take a little bit of time, Honourable Chair, to delve into some of the specific issues in terms of the drafting of the bill. And in the first instance, I'll refer to Section 1B, which regulates the definition of a locksmith. In fact, I won't be referring to that other than to say that our constituent member, the Locksmiths Association of South Africa, made a comprehensive submission on this yesterday. Secondly, Section 1JH, which defines or seeks to define a security service, extends the definition of a security service to those persons or companies involved in the distributing or transporting of security equipment. And that will have the consequence of including persons and companies, we believe, involved in the road freight industry, such as couriers, freight forwarders, and other such businesses into the security industry as service providers of security services. It is our view that whilst it is probably necessary to have regulation dealing with the transportation and distribution of security equipment, this provision, as it is currently written, overextends the mandates of CIRA outside of the scope of the private security industry. And we believe that these provisions should be redrafted to limit that overextension. Also, Section 1K IA, which also talks to the definition of a security service, these new provisions seek to expressly include those security activities involved with the cash or assets in transit subsector of the private security industry. Whilst in general we, as an alliance, welcome the more express and tailored approach to regulating the different activities within the sector, which I've already drawn reference to, the definition in this clause, insofar as it includes other valuables, is too wide. This would possibly have the unintended effect, we would suggest, of rendering the transportation of ostensibly valuable items such as cigarettes, cellular telephone, phones and other computer equipment, etc., into the definition of rendering a security service. We don't believe that that was in fact the intention of the legislator, and we believe that there needs to be some consideration given to how that particular provision is set up. In fact, our recommendation, insofar as that is concerned, is that the definition of valuables should find its source from the legislation related to the South African Reserve Bank, in which the secure transportation of cash and other such instruments are regulated under the legislation of the South African Reserve Bank. Perhaps if we look there, we would find a more purpose-built provision. The provisions that seek to amend sections 20, 23, and 25 that regulate or seek to regulate and limit foreign ownership within the security industry are also problematic for the Alliance. There are essentially two grounds upon which we base this. The first ground upon which we base this is that they are in breach of South Africa's international trade obligations under the General Agreement on Trade in Services, the GATT, which is applicable to all countries that are members of the World Trade Organization, and also South Africa's obligations under the 1994 Agreement for the Promotion and Protection of Investments between the governments of the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland and South Africa, in particular Article 2, which provides that investments of nationals or companies of each contracting party shall at all times be accorded fair and equitable treatment and shall enjoy full protection and security in the territory of the other contracting party. Also, we believe that there is a breach of South Africa's international obligations under the 1999 Agreement on Trade, Development and Cooperation between the European Community and its member states on one hand and the Republic of South Africa on the other. I just pause to note that much of the following submissions are made on the basis of legal advice that was sought by the Alliance and the members of the Alliance in bringing this to the committee. I want to expressly put on record that I personally have no legal qualification. We represent the commercial interests of the industry. Insofar as we believe that the proposed amendments are inconsistent with the Constitution, we believe that the problems with the bill are the following. They are irrational and therefore in breach of the rule of law. They constitute an arbitrary deprivation of property, and we believe that to be a violation of Section 25(1) of the Constitution. And they amount to constructive expropriation and give rise to an uncompensated expropriation of property, which we believe is in violation of Section 25(2)(b) of the Constitution. Insofar as we believe that the provisions are irrational, we say that there are no rational connections between the proposed legislative provision and a legitimate government purpose. In this case, the legislature seeks to introduce amendments to the Act which will extend the requirements for registration as a security service provider to include a majority stake in the ownership and control of security businesses by South African citizens. By expanding the definition of security services to include the distribution and transportation of security equipment, the legislature also intends to extend this requirement to businesses which have never previously been regulated by the Act. It is not entirely clear at this stage what the rationale between the proposed or behind the proposed amendments are. The explanatory memorandum that accompanies the bill does not shed light on the subject, and no explanation is given. However, a number of media reports have indicated that the Ministry of Police believes that foreign-owned private security companies pose a threat to the national security because there are more private security officials in the country than there are police officers and soldiers combined. If this is in fact the motivation, then the amendments the amendments are irrational. Moreover, if the aim sought to be achieved by the bill is the protection of national security from alleged threats posed by the number of private security officials, then introducing a requirement for South African citizen ownership of security businesses will have no impact whatsoever on the comparative numbers of private security officials as compared with police officers. This is because imposing ownership requirements on security businesses has no direct impact on who is employed by those businesses to act as security officials. If what the bill seeks to do is to protect the police against an ever-expanding number of private security officials, the way to achieve that objective is to place restrictions on who may be registered as a security official and the numbers of people who can be registered as security officials. In any event, as the Act already stands, there are detailed requirements for the registration by natural persons as security service providers. There are also requirements that the directors of security businesses, as well as people who undertake executive and management functions in the businesses themselves, be registered as security providers. In order to be registered, a person must be a South African citizen or a permanent resident, and we believe that this provides adequate protection against any perceived risk of against national security. Moreover, the expanded definition of what constitutes a security service provider also has another impact, and that impact is that not only persons who are, it will include, persons who are involved in the installation, repair, and servicing of security equipment, but also those people who are responsible for distributing and transporting security equipment, and they will all have to be 51% owned and controlled by South African citizens. In addition, all of those companies involved in the manufacture of that security and fire protection equipment, perhaps companies such as Sony, Panasonic, and Siemens, will have to restructure their shareholding to ensure that majority ownership is by South African citizens. Honourable Chairperson, insofar as we say that there is arbitrary deprivation of property, we say that if the amendments proposed in the bill are adopted, foreign and juristic shareholders of the security industry will be required to sell their shares within a 5-year period in order to ensure that the businesses are 51% owned and controlled by South African citizens. This would constitute a forced sale of shares, and given that the sale will be made at a time when the market would know that the sale had to take place, it is unlikely that the sellers would receive a fair market value for those shares. In the circumstances, the forced sale is at least at less than fair market value would constitute a deprivation of property. As far as expropriation is concerned, we are advised that the amendments may constitute an invalid expropriation, and this is set out in a little bit of detail in our submission, and was also covered in a previous submission, so I won't spend any time on that. I would, however, like to reflect, Honourable Chairperson, on a number of things. The impact of a limitation of foreign ownership has not been examined sufficiently in our view. Foreign-owned private security companies have transferred technology, developed the skills of, and provided employment opportunities to many South African employees in almost every subsector of the private security industry. And they play a critical role in developing the commercial interests of the sector to the benefit of the entire industry and the country. Almost all security technology, from alarm systems to CCTV systems, are manufactured and distributed by international companies. By the introduction of the various amendments, many of these companies will be compelled to divest, leaving skills, capability, and technical support gaps. And this, in fact, may lead to risks to national security. Many international companies have invested substantially into the sector, and the advent of these limitations will cause irreparable devastation of investor value and may negatively impact on the creation of an open environment for investment and job creation, and could foreseeably extend beyond just the private security sector. We believe that as a developing economy, South Africa should instead be implementing measures that attract foreign direct investment to support domestic investment financing into the sector. despite what is set out in the memorandum of objects that is annexed to the bill, these companies have operated in South Africa for over a decade without any threat to national security. There is no rational reason to believe that such a threat will present itself as a result of foreign investment in the future. The committee is reminded that these provisions, or provisions similar to these, were mooted prior to the promulgation of the 2001 legislation and were removed after a negotiated settlement was reached between the minister and the heads of the large international security companies. And what happened following that negotiated settlement is that these foreign companies have invested heavily into the South African economy, and they continue today to be companies that are in compliance with the legislation and in compliance with all regulations within the sector, and have actually proven themselves to be good corporate citizens within the Republic. There is no reason, Honourable Chairperson, to believe that this will change in the future, or that this will suddenly change to present a threat going forward. Given the expanded scope of the legislation that is proposed in the bill, it is not clear how far the reach of the regulator will extend. Particularly in the electronic security and IT industry, the numbers of companies that will fall under the ambit of the Act will be enormous, and the number of international companies, particularly, that will be impacted on by the limitation of foreign ownership has yet to be quantified and will undoubtedly be substantially damaging both to the sector and the broader economy if this matter is not looked at in more detail before being passed into law. In conclusion, Honourable Chair, we reiterate our support for those parts of the bill that add value and constructive value to the regulation and development of the private security sector, but we must reject those that will impact on the sector negatively. And it is our view that a balance can be struck between these two things. The last item we would like to put on record is that the explanatory memorandum in the memorandum of objects to the bill talks to an open and transparent consultation process. We acknowledge that in October of 2010, a workshop was scheduled between industry stakeholders and CIRA, at which some of these amendments were discussed. We would just like to bring to the attention of the committee that subsequent to that, there has been no feedback on any of the submissions we made at that stage, and more importantly, none of the submissions we made at that stage have found their way into the version of the bill that is before the before Parliament today. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you to you and your team. Members, there you have it. Can I get take questions from members? Honourable Kula Barnard.
Yes. Chair, I'm very concerned about the very final comment that was just made. I'm looking for Mr. Bopela. Is he not here?
He's here, but the deputy chairperson of the council is here.
Could answer. That a workshop was held, and yet the input from the industry was simply not in any way considered in the drawing up of this bill, then why do you bother? Why bother to meet? I mean, is it a tick-box exercise? Now, well, we met with them, tick, done, and then you throw the input away. How is that possible? Why would that happen? Please explain yourselves, because these are the people who work in the industry. This is going to regulate what they do for a living, and yet you take all the input and throw it away. They say nothing that they gave forward in 2010 was implemented in this bill. Please explain.
Any other questions? Honourable Ndlovu? Lelegi Chua?
Chairperson?
Yes.
Is it me?
Yes, you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. To be youngest in this committee sometimes is very bad. Chairperson, the presenter talked about the foreign companies, and he said that he used two words, which expropriation and removal. I want him to explain that, because the bill is not using those two words. Why use that words? And then the rearrangement of employees. And he's linking that to these people, to the 51%, and the limitation thereof. I hope you understand my question. If he doesn't understand my question, I'll
it seems like he needs more clarity.
He needs more clarity.
Honourable Chair, just on the part of the question that concerns employees, I don't understand the link between that and the rest of the question. Thank you.
Honourable Ntlovu?
Yes, Chairperson. He talked about foreign companies. He talked about Sony, Siemens, and others. And then when he talked about that, he talked about the rearrangement of their employees. That's the first one. That's the first question. But linked to that, he talked about limitation provided employment to the local. Those companies, in other words, they provided employment to the local people. He talked about that. I want him to link it. I hope you understand now my question, where I'm coming from. And then the second question, he talked about technical gaps that may be caused by changing the ownership. Technical gaps. What are these technical gaps that he's referring to? Technical gaps. That the last one, Chairperson, is arbitration suspension of service providers. Can you just elaborate on that so that they will understand exactly where it comes from? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Ndlovu. Honourable Mulaleki George?
No, I've only got one question, Madam Chair. The question is, you talked about skills and equipment being lost. I thought if you change ownership of the company, you don't tamper with whatever equipment they are using, whatever expertise they are using. Now, why do you bring the question of skills and equipment being lost?
Question from any other question from members? I have a couple of questions as well. I find the your positives for the bill quite interesting, because I'm wondering whether you've got the right expectations around the positives. First of all, what is your expectation? What do you read in terms of the firearm register, etc.? What are you reading? What is your understanding of it? So that we can get a clear that we don't mislead you and you don't mislead us around that. I can also mention to you that I believe that we will have to relook that thing, not in terms of the relationship, but in terms of the responsibility and where it lies. Second thing is the issue around the funding that you raise as well. Again, I want to know what your expectation around that is, because it does not mean that the industry will no longer have a funding responsibility. It will still be paying levies. I just want to get a clear understanding of what your expectation of that is. A question that I also want to address to Sira, it is unfortunate that it's not the first time that the issue of consultation comes up. And I think when you made the presentation on Tuesday, you listed the just want to get your presentation. You listed, but you mentioned numbers. You didn't mention, in some instances, you mentioned numbers. You said so many government departments, if I remember correctly. I'm just trying to get to that page. I think you need to be explicit about the consultation process. You said 13 government departments and state entities. Who are they? Who are those 13 government departments and state entities? 8 industry associations, and then you list Security Industry Alliance, which includes the following: Vehicle Security Association of South Africa, Security Services Employers Association, South African Intruder Detection Service Association. Who are the other four? Who are they? We now know Locksmith was there as well, but they most probably were there as part of CR, I'm not sure. So who are the other four? And who are the 10 trade unions that have been consulted? Those are my questions. You can respond to those questions. Members, after the answers, we will break 14.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I take it that the Honourable Kola Barnard was not posing a question to me, so I have nothing to answer on that, other than to reiterate the point that we were consulted on a single occasion, expecting that that was the start or the commencement of a process of engagement and exchange, which it wasn't, and secondly, that none of the submissions we made were really taken into cognizance or changed the provisions of the current bill. I hope I understand the questions posed by Honourable Ndlovu correctly in the following answers. Insofar as the words expropriation and removal do not appear in the bill, we say that they needn't appear ostensibly in the bill if the effect that the enactment of the bill will have is to expropriate or arbitrarily deprive security companies with foreign ownership of property that they may own. It doesn't matter that it doesn't say so explicitly in the provisions of the legislation. If that is the effect, then that is what is happening, and we believe that that cannot be allowed to continue. As far as technical gaps are concerned, and I think this also relates to the question raised by the Honourable Member George around the technical gaps and skills and equipment. We're referring here specifically to the fact that international companies that manufacture and distribute security equipment and provide the skilled resource in the form of their employees for the ongoing maintenance and support of those systems, if companies were no longer able to hold majority shareholding in their core businesses in South Africa, they are likely to divest entirely. And in divesting entirely, that security equipment that may already be installed in various places, including national key points, other key installations, major customer sites, would be left without the technical capacity to service and maintain them, but also be left without the ability to upgrade or renew that equipment on an ongoing basis. So when we talk about technical gaps and when we talk about skills and equipment, that's really what we're referring to. Every or most CCTV cameras and alarm systems are manufactured and distributed by companies that are not locally owned. Then to the questions raised by the Chair, our expectations of the bill insofar as the positives go are the following. Firstly, in relation to the firearms register, we envisage that in the event that the regulator has more easy access to information and records around the licensing of firearms and around the competencies of employees within the private security sector to carry those firearms, we would be able to engage more constructively on resolving some of the practical problems that we have in the sector at the moment in relation to those firearms. I think, although it was not part of our submission, it's probably common cause by now that the industry is plagued by a persistent problem in getting the administration around firearms, both in the licensing of the firearms themselves and in the competency certificates of employees. And that is a significant business hindrance. And we believe that if the regulator were involved in the process, the regulator that we have an ongoing relationship with or should have, in the form of the regulation that they provide, we would be able to expedite some of those processes and we would be able to clear some of the blockages that are there. Whether that is naive or not, Honourable Chair, perhaps it is, but we take a generally positive view. As far as the funding goes, I think it's also common cause that there is a pending litigation between the Security Industry Alliance and CIRA concerning amongst other things, the fact that almost overnight the fees payable by security service providers were increased by 1,000%. It's our view that the reason or the rationale for that astronomical and unreasonable increase was that there was inadequate access to alternative funding by CIRA. And we believe not that we would cease to pay levies, but that levies would remain reasonable in light of the fact that the regulatory function could be performed with the assistance of an alternative source of funding through the budget. Honourable Chair. I think...
Before I allow CIRA to respond to the issue of consultation, how desirable do you believe it is that the industry have representation on the council? You've motivated for it, but yet you're not funding it. They are your regulators. Would it not be a conflict of interest to have a representative, and you didn't even argue for one, you argued for a couple of them, on the council? Can you just respond to that before we allow Sira to respond to the other question?
Honourable Chair, may I just clarify, when you say funding, you mean by means of levies?
Look, if the levies are, if we go the route that is suggested in the bill, then it means the levies, and that is a shortcoming that we've identified to CIRA on the first day already, then it means the levies need to be paid over to this fiscus, and CIRA will have to apply for those levies. Levies is a tax. So what we're saying is you are not, in essence, funding this. You're also acknowledging your unwillingness to continue to fund it, basically, and that's why you're also going to court around the 1,000%. Not only that, it is a huge unwanted increase. But how, the two issues, but I think the main issue is, how desirable is it for the industry to have representation on the council that is its regulating authority? Not moving back to where we were then, prior to the Principal Act.
Honourable Chair, it's our view that having participation in structures such as the Council of the Regulator is more desirable than the situation we have now, simply because it would allow CIRA as a regulator to become more effective in its responsibilities in terms of regulating the sector, because it would be more in tune and more in touch with the issues that are faced by the industry. I think the absence of some formalized mechanism by which CIRA must take on board what industry stakeholders such as employer bodies and trade unions have to say means that they become increasingly distant from the day-to-day realities within the sector. And we believe that from a purely practical perspective, the inclusion of other stakeholders in that process will bring a degree of pragmatism to the activities of the regulator. Because in the main, we don't believe that the problems related to the absence of regulation within our sector have their roots in a deficiency in the legislation. We believe that they have their root in a deficiency in the administration of the legislation. And so with bringing the industry on board, we believe that we will bring that exact pragmatism and those solutions that we know will work on the ground. We bring the practical side of it to the thinking of the council.
I don't want to go into a debate, and I take your point, but can another option not be to put in the bill, while we're busy doing it, a false consultative process for the council or the agency with the industry, and we can formalise that process as well?
Honourable Chair, I would suggest that would be a worthwhile alternative to look at.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Perhaps let me start by commending CIRA for highlighting all the positives in the bill. I think it's the first organisation to do that since the hearings have started. Specific to the aspect of consultation, let me start by addressing the question by the Honourable Member
Caller Bernard. We have had consultations in which CA was part of the consultations, and they've made several representations to us during the consultations, and there was debates and there was exchange of that. And I would like to state that it is not correct that we did not consider any of their submissions. First, if I recall, they made submissions regarding state funding that is in the bill, because they've claimed at the time that we would not like to see the industry fees going up. That is in the bill. Secondly, they've also highlighted that there has been a lot of criminality in the industry, to the extent that they, at one stage, and I'm quite sure that it is still the process now, created their own mini criminal record center where they do their own vetting of security officers that have been vetted. That is being addressed also in the bill. And we've said, and I think I've attended one of the board meetings where I was invited by the board of CIA. We had a discussion more or less about the issue, and the question was asked by myself to, are you aware that the current legislation allows persons with criminal records to be in the industry? And they said that they were aware, but it looks like the problem is growing. That is the reason why they were creating their own database. I said, okay, but we are considering legislation, and here we come and we're saying we don't want to see criminals in the industry. So that consideration has been taken into account. It is, of course, true that we cannot consider, although we have considered, we cannot take on board every submission that is made by everyone we consult, and I don't think that is possible, Madam Chair. Regarding the question of how many departments, who are the departments that we've consulted, I have a list in front of me. We have consulted the Department of International Relations and Corporations, the Department of Labor, South African Human Rights Commission, Statistics South Africa, Department of Home Affairs, the National Prosecuting Authority, Secretariat of Police, Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, Department of Public Service and Administration, Department of Defense, National Treasury and State Security, State Security Agency. The associations that we've consulted, the Vehicle Association of South Africa, Security Industry Alliance, Locksmith Association of South Africa, Fire Detection Installers Association, South African Banking and Risk Information Center, Security Services Employers Organization, South African Intruder Detection Services Association, South African Institute of Security. In terms of the trade unions, it was the South African Private Security Workers Union, Kungwini Amalgamated Workers Union, South African Transport and Allied Workers Union, Transport and Allied Workers Union, National Defense Change and Allied Workers Union, South African Cleaning and Allied Workers Union, Protectors Workers Union, United People's Union of South Africa, United Private Sector Union of South Africa, and the Professional Transport Workers Union. That is the list of the bodies that we have.
Make that list available as well, please. Just make the list available, please. Yeah, the one department you didn't mention is SAPS.
Of course, Madam Chair, my apologies. SAPS was all the way part of the consultations as well.
Any outstanding issues that you would like to raise before we break for a 15-minute tea? Honourable Holtzman. Honourable. Let me just take the member, then I'll come back to you.
Could you just clarify? I don't know, maybe it was mentioned in our portfolio committee earlier in the year. I don't recall. Did you put up the fees by 1,000%? It was mentioned. I'm sorry, I must have blocked it out.
members, it was mentioned, it was during the time that we were having the DPCI process as well, when we had Ciro there the afternoon, it was mentioned that the committee raised its concern around this issue and around the way that it was done as well. So it was mentioned to this committee. I'll kindly remind members about it. The Deputy Chair of the Council, Ms. Holtzman.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, and thank you for the honour earlier. Just a response to the question raised by the Honourable Member, Colour Barnard. Our chairperson, unfortunately, is ill and had to leave. I think we tried to indicate it even so from the first day. It wasn't well at all, so apologies. And then secondly, our apologies for being late. I noted the Chair's comments. Unfortunately, there seemed to have been some misunderstanding with regards to the change of venue, and I'm not sure where the communication went, but our apologies for that.
Your office was informed at around 11 this morning that there's a change in venue. The Secretary spoke to Ms. Dubé. Members, there's a 15-minute tea break, 4:15. We're back, please.